Okay, let us talk a little bit about this Torah portion that actually, in a way, began last week, and that's really where I'm going to start. But this one is called Pinchas. In English, people will say Phinehas. And it begins in Numbers chapter 25, actually, technically in verse 10 or so. Depends on whether you're looking at a Hebrew English Bible or a another kind of an English Bible, but it's in that vicinity. And it says in verse 10, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moses, saying, Pinchas, or Phinehas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, Aaron's grandson, in other words, has turned my wrath away from the B'nai Israel." Okay, so, wait a second, what are we talking about here, right? This story, like I said, really kind of began last week, and it had to do with whoring. And it had to do with idolatry, and it had to do with pagan worship, and it had to do with Baal Peor. And it even perhaps had to do with Balaam. Remember the prophet who was told, "You're not allowed to say anything except what I tell you," when it comes to not cursing, but in fact blessing the children of Israel. And indeed he did. But it would seem that before Balak and Balaam separated and went on their respective individual ways, there's a little bit more to the story. Because Israel began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab, and it would seem from what happens in Numbers 31, the end of the story, that it was Balaam that put them up to that. And basically, these women of Moab came and they literally seduced the men of Israel and called the people, it says in verse 2, to make sacrifices of their gods. They ate, they bowed down to these gods, and Israel began to join himself unto Baal of Peor. And that really did not set well with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, king and creator of the universe. His anger was kindled, it says. So, Yahuwah tells Moshe, "Take all the chiefs, hang them up unto Yahuwah in the face of the sun, that the fierce anger of Yahuwah may turn away from Israel." So Moshe goes to the judges and he says, "Look, go out and you slay every single man that has joined themselves unto these fake gods, unto Baal, the Lord of Peor." And here is now where the story really begins to set the stage for this week. One of the children of Israel, turns out that we're going to find out his name in a second. It was Zimri, son of Salu. He was a Simeonite. And he goes right smack in brazen defiance, I guess you'd have to say, brings into his tent, right among his brethren, a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moshe, in the sight of all the congregation of all of the children of Israel, who were still weeping at the door of the tent of meeting. And he took her into the tent to make pagan whoopee, basically. Now, there is a plague already in place, killing people left and right. Phinehas, Pinchas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron, saw it. He rose up, he took a spear in his hand, he went into the chamber where they were doing the dirty deed, and they literally ran both of them through with a spear. And it says, so the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. Those that died, 24,000. All right, that's where our portion this week begins, and it starts with a really interesting and admittedly downright problematic statement, because here's a man that some would say has committed murder. Well, he slayed two people, at least. It's not murder in the sense that, well, he obviously had a pretty good reason for it. He certainly took a risk. And I think that's the thing about this that's so interesting that I want to always spend a minute or two on, at least as we talk about it. This guy is doing something. Well, actually, three people are doing something. You've got the Midianitish woman. Her name was Cozbi, daughter of Zur. She was a highfalutin type as well. And then you've got Zimri, who was a chief among the Simeonites, who should ought have known better. And then, of course, you've got Pinchas, who sees it and literally takes matters into his own hands, slays both of them, and stays the plague. The Midrash will suggest, you know what, there could have been a whole lot of people that were very, very upset with what Pinchas did. And in fact, he may have been taking his life into his own hand. he was certainly taking a real risk here. Certainly, too, if you look at most of Torah, to commit an act like this of violence and bloodshed is frowned upon, to put it mildly. And yet, that's not exactly what happens. Pinhas, son of Eleazar, son of Aaron the priest, has turned my wrath away, says the king of the universe, from the B'nai Israel, in that he was very zealous for my sake among them, so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my jealousy. So therefore I say, behold, I am going to give him a covenant of peace. As a matter of fact, it's going to be an everlasting covenant. It'll be unto him, unto his seed after him, the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. The Midrash says that up until this point, even though he was a Levite and of the line of Aaron, he was not really a Kohen yet. So this is kind of like how he earned his Kohenhood, if you want to put it that way. And in the process, he showed that he was in fact zealous for his Elohim, and he made atonement for the children of Israel. Now, it tells us the names of all these folks, and ultimately, like I said a couple times, this is a problematic story. I'm going to kind of come back to this theme. We may talk a little bit, too, about the only other person in the Tanakh that is called zealous for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and that is Elijah, or Eliyahu, the prophet. He shows up in 1 Kings chapter 19 with a story that I find fascinating, always like to tell, and it involves Ahab and Jezebel and the priests of Baal and a number of things. There's all kinds of lessons in the lives here. So probably what we're going to do is talk about the rest of the portion, come back to that as we tie some of these things together. Anyway, chapter 25 ends this way, Harax, or Vex, and it's Zaror is the term there that's used. Harass the Midianites, smite them, for they harass you. They have literally come in and seduced, beguiled you in the matter of Peor, he says, in the matter of Cozbi, daughter of Prince of Midian, and their sister, who was slain in the day of the plague in the matter of Peor. Maybe it shouldn't surprise us that the very next thing we see in chapter 26 is another census. We had one in chapter 2 of this same book, the book of Numbers, hence the English name, telling us how many of each of the various tribes there were. If you remember, there were 603,500 people that entered into the wilderness in that early part, 40 years prior to this. And now we're going to find out, after this 24,000 were dead, and after the carcasses of all of those who were destined to die in the wilderness have done so, well, just how many people there are in each of the houses. And I always find the numbers interesting. I won't claim. Isaac Newton, I don't think, was able to do it either, so I'm not going to be too surprised that some of us, perhaps lesser minds, haven't been able to quite wrap our heads around it. But when you see this degree of detail in Scripture and all these numbers, you got to figure there's probably more here than meets the eye. And one of the things that I did was, as I was looking at this again, write down the numbers and look at them and compare them to Numbers chapter 2 and just kind of see if anything sticks out at you. For example, it starts by telling us, once again, do a head count. Take the sum of all the congregation of the B'nai Israel, all of those from 20 years old and up by their father's houses. This is the ones, again, that are able to go to war. So we're not going to see the Levites listed in here. And Moshe and Eleazar the priest spoke with them. They're in Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. And they take the commandment, and then we see the results of it, taking the census. Reuben, firstborn of Israel, sons of Reuben, it lists them. And interestingly, in chapter 26 here, it goes into a bit more detail. Tells us of the sons of the sons and the names of more people than it did the first time out. For example, and I won't go through all of them, but in the sons of Reuben, you got Hanak of the family of the Hanakites, Palu of the Paluites, Hezron, and then Carmi. These, it says, when all is said and done, are the families of the Reubenites and those that were numbered of them. Remember, these are 20 years old and up. There were 43,730 in Reuben. And then we go through some others. Tells us, by the way, here that you got the situation with Korah, who were swallowed alive, 250 men. But the sons of Korah didn't die. Now we got, and by the way, why does that show up in here? I always think, as you go through this listing, it is interesting to see how periodically Scripture will just kind of give us what I've sometimes referred to as a Tasmanian downshift. It's not. There's a point to putting this reminder about Korah that were devoured and the 250 men right in here. And we know part of the reason, of course, has to do with those that that died. But the sons of Korah, who would have been Levites, did not die, it says. Chapter 26, verse 12, says next, the sons of Simeon and their families. We're going to get the list. There were 22,200 of them. Then we hear about Gad and Judah and Issachar and so forth. So I wrote the numbers in the margin, put them on a piece of paper, and checked them out. Just say, okay, now what do we got here? Let's do this quick comparison. First off, Numbers 2, 40 years ago, remember, the total was 603,550. Now, when all is said and done, Scripture tells us, you add them up, 601,730. Basically, that's pretty close. There are about 2,000 less men of age 20 or above now than there were. So that's a lot of people whose carcasses fell out there in the wilderness. But by and large, what we've seen is that the population has been fairly stable. However, what kind of sticks out at you as you go through this list and put all the families in here is, well, one, in chapter 2 of Numbers, they're in a different order. They're numbered by camps, north, south, east, and west, remember, as they were to be camped around. And in this case, we get a different ordering as well. Reuben, Simeon, Gad, Judah, Issachar. Well, some of them are similar. They're in sets of three, but they're not quite in the same order. The other thing is that when you go through the numbers here, there are some that are radically different. For example, among the firstborn Reuben, you know, they're down a few thousand. It went from 46 and change to just under 44,000. That's fairly stable. Gad had a little bit bigger decline. There were 45,000 and change of those. Now they're down about 5,000. That's percentage-wise a pretty big drop. But nothing compared to what happened with the tribe of Simeon. Simeon went from almost 60,000, 59,300, down to, as we just heard, 22,200. There are two-thirds less of the tribe of Simeon than there were. There are some others that basically have small changes. Benjamin, the number of Benjaminites went up by about 25%. Asher, similarly, they increased fairly noticeably, but nothing like what we saw with Manasseh, one of the two tribes that make up together Joseph. They, the tribe of Manasseh, literally almost doubled. They went from 32,200 to 52,700. I don't necessarily have any conclusions to draw from that, but I do think all these numbers are interesting. And they're important in this sense, too, because as what we're going to see next, they are fixing to go into the land, and now there's going to be a division of the land, and that division is going to be roughly proportional to the populations here. So those that have a bigger population are going to get more percentage-wise than they would have had they not increased as they did. I see the comments on the screen, and I guess I tend to say I would agree. Basically, the comment is, right, is there some kind of behavioral connection? In other words, do we look at these numbers and draw any conclusions about the relative merits of the tribe, how good they were, and so forth? I'm tempted to think that that could be the case, too. Are the sins of the father visited upon the sons? The sons can certainly choose not to follow in their father's footsteps. Bottom line is, I'm not sure, and I don't know that we can make a really good case from what we see here. But I'm open to studying it and continuing to look at it. Let's move on to chapter 27, because chapter 27, well, let me finish with chapter 26, because the last couple lines here, of course, are important, even though we already knew they were going to happen, right? These are they who were numbered, it says, by Moshe and Eleazar, by the plains of Moab, by the Jordan at Jericho. But it reminds us there was not a man among them that was numbered by Moshe and Aaron 40 years ago, who numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness, because they had been told, you will surely die in the wilderness. And so, except for Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, son of Nun, there wasn't a one of them left. All right, chapter 27 tells us, and this is the second time in this portion, that these names are going to appear. The daughters of Zelophehad. The daughters of Zelophehad. These are, interestingly enough, of the tribe of Manasseh. The one I was just saying has doubled up on us, almost. Son of Hefer, son of Gilead, son of Machir, son of Manasseh. Of the families of Manasseh, son of Yosef. And here are the names of these five daughters. Mahla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they came before Moshe and Eleazar and before all the princes, and they said, look, here's the deal, guys. Our father died in the wilderness, and he was not among those that gathered themselves in the rebellion of Korah, but he died, in fact, in his own sin. Oh, and he didn't have any sons either. So why should it be that the name of our father would be done away with from our family? Because he had no son. So they asked and said, can you give us a possession among the brethren of our father? And here is another one of these cases where normally Moshe would deal with this himself. There's a lot in the Midrash on this. Is this a failing of Moshe, that he couldn't figure this out on his own? He couldn't make a decree. Well, it's not the first time. And certainly what happens here is worthy of being recorded in Scripture, so I guess I don't take as much fault with Moshe as some have inclined to do, saying that he could have come up with this on his own. In any case, he does go to Yahuwah, who tells him, these daughters of Zelophehad, they speak rightly. So give them a possession of an inheritance among their father's brothers. Let the inheritance of their father pass to them. And then he issues this decree, basically. Speak to the children of Israel, tell them, if a man dies, he doesn't have any sons, then the inheritance will go to his daughter. If he doesn't have a daughter, then you give his inheritance to his brothers. And if you don't have any brothers even, then you give his inheritance to his father's brethren, his uncles and their kin, essentially. And even if his father has no brothers, then you give the inheritance unto his kinsman next of kin in the family, and he shall possess it. So what is being laid out here, thanks to the pleadings of the daughters of Zelophehad, are the inheritance rules in Scripture. And then we see something else that's interesting. Now, there's a lot that's been made about the sequence here, and I think it's important to point out before I get to verse 12. What are we seeing? What are we seeing in this portion? Well, we see the story of Pinchas, who by his zealotry stays the plague. And then we get a review of the census so that we can do some comparison and say, all right, all those folks that were supposed to have died as they were told, in fact, did, except for the two. Here are the numbers of the tribes that are now left that are getting ready to inherit the land. That gives us a clue as to how that inheritance is going to work out and how things are going to be passed down. We hear the story about how this fellow Zelophehad, who has died, leaving only daughters, well, his name is not going to perish. Everybody, in other words, even some of the sons of the various families here, get a name. They get a legacy. Except for, there's a question that is immediately raised. Yahuwah says unto Moshe, now get up to this mountain of Abarim. Behold, spy out, take a look over the land which I've given to the children of Israel. And when you've seen it, you are going to be gathered unto your people, just as your brother Aaron was gathered. In other words, you are going to die. Because you rebelled against my commandment in the wilderness of Zin, you failed to set me apart, to sanctify me at those waters before their eyes. Meribah Kadesh. Now, we recall, at least it would seem like Moshe had some sons, Gershom, Eleazar. What about that? Does he, in all of this discussion of legacy and all these discussions of inheritance, the Midrash essentially says, you know, it almost cries out. Here's poor Moshe. What does he get? He gets told, you're getting ready to die. Go take a look at the land from the top of this mountain. And then what's the next thing that happens? Well, he says to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, let Yahuwah, the God, the Elohim of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation. He does seem to be chiefly concerned at this point about who is going to take over for him when he's gone. This person who may go out before them, who may come in before them, lead them out, and may bring them back in. That the congregation of Yahuwah is not to be like sheep with no shepherd. Some of the folks that read this say, hey, maybe he was asking, can Gershom be the guy who leads after I'm gone? I don't necessarily buy that one. There's a lot of speculation about why it is that the man who's picked here, and we know it's going to be Joshua, why it is, who it is that's picked. Was Moshe really saying he would like it to be Gershom? I don't necessarily buy that, like I said. What it does seem that Moshe is most concerned about is that this be a person who is a good leader. And Yahuwah says to him, take Joshua, son of Nun, a man in whom is spirit, ruach. And the present tense is used there. In other words, already he's got this spirit within him. Lay your hands upon him, set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and give him a charge in their sight, and put a bit of some of your honor upon him, so that all of the children of Israel, all the congregation, Kol Edat, may hearken. And he'll stand before Eleazar and inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before Yahuwah. And at his word, just as you've said, essentially, they'll go out. At his word, they'll come in, both he and all the children of Israel, even Kol Ha'edah, all of the congregation. And Moshe did as he was commanded. And he set him before Eleazar, who laid his hands upon him, gave him a charge. So now we see the mantle is being passed. And at that point, now we get a another shift in gear here, and we're going to hear about the things that are going to happen when they go into the land. So we're going to get another repetition. And this leads me again to remark on, you know what, folks? In the last week, I've had discussions online with a few folks, and it seems like among what I sometimes refer to as ex-Christianity, this always comes up. Oh, that Old Testament, all done away with. Jesus did away with all that stuff. We don't have that stuff anymore. And it leads me to ask the question, why, for crying out loud, did he say otherwise in so many places? And why does the creator of the universe feel a need to repeat it so many times? Unless maybe he just plain knew that that was going to be the excuse and that people weren't going to get it and that they would do exactly this and turn away from it. So one more time, we see Yahuwah speaks to Moshe and he says, command the B'nai Israel. I asked the question, would you like to be grafted in? Do we want to consider ourselves among the children of Israel? Whether you want to say brides or grafted into the root or any of 100 different metaphors that we see in Scripture, if we wanted to be counted among that number, maybe it makes sense that we would understand what it is that the children of Israel are told so many times to do. Even if, because we're not in the land and because there is no temple or no Mishkan, no synagogue, even if these offerings can't be made necessarily, there certainly is something to be said for at least having some understanding about them and about the feasts. So I'll go through this fairly briefly, but I do want to make sure we talk about it at least. Here are the things that you are to say to them. This is my food presented unto me for offerings made by fire. And what I find interesting here, the word for these offerings, right? You've heard the term korban, and this is karbani. Bani, remember that? That's the possessive ending. These are mine. A sweet savor unto me. Observe to offer to me in its due season. And here's what you're to tell them. And basically what we're going to see are a bunch of specifications for these offerings. An offering made by fire. He lambs of the first year. Without blemish, two. Basically, there's going to be one in the morning, one in the evening for a continual burnt offering. So this is kind of your base activity, if you will. Every day, plain old days and not so plain old days. You get a lamb in the morning and another lamb in the evening, along with some other things that go with it. 10th part of an ephah of fine flour. So there's a meal offering. It's mingled with the 4th part of a hin of beaten oil. And then this, it says, is to be continual, offered in Mount Sinai for a sweet savor, made by fire unto Yahuwah. And then it talks about a drink offering, too, a 4th part of a hin for one lamb. You pour out a drink offering, a strong drink, and then the other lamb you present at dusk. And all of these things basically are going to happen continually. Finally, then, we have a special offering on the Sabbath day. Now it's 2 he lambs of the first year without blemish, an ephah of fine flour, and so forth. So this is essentially the daily offering plus. This, it says in verse 10, is a burnt offering every Sabbath, but besides, in addition to the continual burnt offering and the regular drink offering. All right, we got another one we're going to talk about on the new moons, Rosh Chodesh. Present a burnt offering unto Yahuwah, and it's a little bit more involved. This time, 2 young bulls, a ram, 7 he-lambs of the first year without blemish, and again, 3/10 part of an ephah of fine flour mingled with oil for each bull, 2/10 of fine flour mingled with oil for the one ram, and several 10ths part of fine flour mingled with oil for a meal offering for every lamb, and for a burnt offering, sweet savor, fire, unto Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And for the drink offerings, now it's a hin of wine, half a hin of wine for the bull, a 3rd part of a hin for the ram, and a 4th part of a hin for the lamb. This is to be continual every new moon throughout the months of the year. All of this, again, is in addition to the daily offering. And then we're going to talk about those other special set-apart appointed times. For example, first month, 14 day, the Passover of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And it reminds us again, on this 15th day is a feast, 7 days, unleavened bread to be eaten. First day, holy convocation, no manner of servile work. But you are to present that offering made by fire, a burnt offering. And now we get a little bit more specification. I won't go through all of the details of all of these at this point, simply because, again, we cannot do them. But I will suggest that we can at least memorialize all of these things, and it's important that when we, particularly at these times of the year, think about and understand what it is that's being talked about here, and what it is that we can do and what we can't do. 7th day, at the end of this week, it tells us, is also a set-apart convocation, no manner of servile work on that day. Then it takes us to the day of first fruits. You bring a meal offering unto Yahuwah. In your feast of weeks, again, you do no manner of servile work, but you do present a burnt offering, 2 young bulls, 1 ram, 7 he-lambs of the first year, and the meal offerings and the things that go with that. Besides this continual burnt offering, these meal offerings, you offer these things along with the drink offering. And that takes us to the last chapter in here, which is chapter 29. It says, here are the rest of them. 7th month, first day of the month. This is the fall feast, the first one. And we already know what that's going to be. No manner of servile work. It is a day of blowing the trumpet, the shofar. Yom Teruah. And sometimes you'll see it translated as day of shouts. And a teruah, of course, is a particular blast on the ram's horn. We talk about it as it can be translated shout or as that particular type of blowing. But the key is, this is a day that, at least when I read it and I summarize it, I like to put it this way. This is essentially the kickoff. The ram's horn, if you will, blowing of this trumpet, this teruah, sets the things in motion that follow. 7th day, first day of the month. And I'll point this out one more time, too. This is the only set-apart feast during the appointed times of Yahuwah in the year that falls always at the new moon. And that's part of the reason why you'll hear it referred to as this, the one feast that no man knows the hour or the day. And that's part of the reason why, I don't call it a doctrine, but I certainly at least tend, as for me in my house, to treat it this way. I tend to think that's the reason why it should be celebrated beginning when the new moon is sighted. Because when it's sighted by 2 or 3 witnesses is essentially something that no man knows the hour or the day up until it's sighted. Could be clouds. Could be that the calculations are a bit off. Could be he just changes things for whatever reason to meet his requirements. In other words, it's his time clock that gets started, not ours. So I like that concept anyway, of starting the fall feasts with the sighting of the new moon and recognizing, you know what, maybe a day earlier than we think or a day or two later than we think, and it's all about his time clock, not so much ours. So on that day, they're to prepare a burnt offering, sweet savor, one young bull, one ram, 7 he lambs of the first year without blemish, and the meal offerings, the fine flour and the oil, and the things that go with it. One he-goat for a sin offering, it concludes in verse 5, to make atonement for you, besides the burnt offering of the new moon and the meal offering thereof and the continual burnt offering and meal offerings and drink offerings. These things are cumulative. So you've got the regular one that happens every day. You've got the new moon one that happens, and now you've got this additional one for this very special time of Yom Teruah. Then we start to count. The 10th day of that 7th month, we have a holy convocation. This is Yom Kippur, Yom HaKippurim, the day of covering, of atonement. You are to afflict your souls. Ve ana, ani, let's see. Anitem. I think that's how that should be pronounced. Ana is the word there that means to be afflicted or oppressed or humbled or bowed down. And this is typically referred to as kind of the most set apart, the holiest, and in some respects, the most solemn day of the entire year. But you present a burnt offering, if you had a place to do it, unto Yahuwah, a sweet savor, one young bull, 7 he lambs, out without blemish, and the meal offerings, the fine flour mixed with oil, and the things that go with the bulls and the rams, and the different parts for each one of the 7 lambs. On the 15th day. Oh, let me make one more comment about verse 7 there. No manner of work is a very, very different specification than the one that usually is told to us, like it is on the Pesach and this day that we just had with Yom Teruah. No manner of servile work. You know, it's not an employment type of work. Some people will call these cooking days, where cooking is okay, but not the kind of things that you would call normal work-a-day, get paid, or earn a living, or do servile work for others kind of thing. Whereas on Yom Kippur, it is no work, period. Afflict your soul. Which brings us now to the 15th day of the month. Have a holy convocation, no manner. Now this time it's back to servile work again. And now we're to keep a feast unto Yahuwah for 7 days. I'll admit it, fall feast, Sukkot, this is my favorite time of the year. Once again, there's a burnt offering unto Yahuwah. And this one is kind of interesting. The numbers change. The numbers are always interesting. Here's more numbers in the book of Numbers. On the first day, it says, you are to present a burnt offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah, 13 young bullocks, 2 rams, 14 he-lambs of the first year without blemish, with the meal offering, the fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 parts for every bull, 2/10 for each ram of the 2 rams, and a several 10th part for every lamb of the 14 lambs. This is a whole different kind of prescription than what we get for the rest of the year. And there's a lot more meat here as well. If you go through the pattern, it says on the second day, now it's 12 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 he lambs. And on the third day, 11 bulls, 2 rams, 14 he lambs. Looks like what's happening is the following. The bulls, the bullocks, count down. Each day, as we work through that week, the number of bulls goes down by 1. Goes 14, 13, 12, and so forth. Whereas the number of the other animals stays the same. 2 rams, 14 he lambs on every day. So by the time we get to the 7th day, you're down to 7 bullocks, 2 rams, still 14 he lambs of the first year without blemish. So I've got a little equation written in the margins here. The number of days plus the number of bulls equals 14, and the number of he lambs looks like it remains at 14, which is 2 times 7. Make of that what you will. The chapter ends by telling us, these are the things that you are to offer unto Yahuwah in your appointed seasons. All of this, besides your vows and your free will offerings, whether they're burnt offerings or meal offerings or drink offerings or peace offerings. So before we close on the Torah portion this evening, let's talk just briefly about the Haftorah portion from 1 Kings chapter 19 and the prophet Elijah. The other zealot that's mentioned in Scripture. Because, literally, these are the only two that we see that are called, zealots or zealous for Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. That's why the covenant of peace was issued to Pinchas. And what I'm going to do is just review quickly the story from chapter 19, where you know that Eliyahu, or Elijah, has been pretty bold with Ahab. And we've just had the story about the priests of Baal, and how Eliyahu essentially made fun of them and then proved that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was the real Elohim. He said, you know, why are you going to, how long are you going to be of two minds? If God be God, serve him. If Baal be God, serve him. Well, it ends up that the people of Israel figure it out. Elijah says, seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let one of them escape. And then, essentially, Eliyahu hears that Jezebel, having heard in turn about what he had done, is some kind of peeved. Now, I don't know about you folks, but when I see names like Jezebel in Scripture and I picture her angry, I'll admit, I think of certain female politicians and I picture them. It's just a force of habit, I guess. Jezebel sent a messenger and told the prophet, if so will the gods do to me, so let them do to me and more also, if I do not take your life. Make your life as like one of them by tomorrow about this time. So basically, if you will, Jezebel puts out a contract on Eliyahu. That would be the appearance anyway. And he ran for his life. And he goes, all over the place. The story is interesting, but he ends up in a cave. Spent the night in the place, and then he has a vision here. The word of Yahuwah came to him, and he said, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? And the prophet responds. Now, the prophet's response is interesting. It includes this word, I have been very zealous for Yahuwah, Lord of hosts. For the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. I've mentioned the story, Isaiah's job, and how, you know, here it is, that this prophet who has such great vision otherwise seems to miss something really important at a vital time. But we're not quite to that part of the story yet. Then Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh says, go out, stand on the mountain before Yahuwah. And now he has this vision. Yahuwah passes by. There's a strong wind that tore down the mountains, broke the rocks in pieces before Yahuwah. But here comes the key words. But Yahuwah was not in the wind. And after the wind came an earthquake. But Yahuwah was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire. But Yahuwah was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. So it was, when Eliyahu heard it, he wrapped up his face and his mantle, he went out and he stood in the entrance of the cave. And suddenly a voice came to him and said, same thing as before, what are you doing here, Eliyahu? And he said, I have been, listen to this folks, it's exactly word for word the thing that he just told the creator of the universe. Almost like he missed the point. And that's kind of what hits me as I look at this. Sometimes we get told more than once and we still don't quite get it. What does he tell him? He says, I've been very zealous for Yahuwah Zevuot, Lord of hosts, because, say it with me, the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. He didn't get it, I think. At least that's how I read it. You know, your mileage may vary. Yahuwah then says something interesting to him. He says, all right, go. Return your way to the wilderness of Damascus. When you arrive, now he's going to give him an assignment here. You're going to anoint two kings. Hazael as king over Syria, and also Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And you're going to appoint Elisha, son of Shaphat. You're going to anoint him as prophet in your stead. Gee, that sounds a little bit like Moshe, getting a little bit of a comeuppance at the end. Now, as it turns out, we know what's going to happen to Eliyahu, too. But he's done, essentially, at this point, of being the sole prophet. Here it is that he is told, now you're going to appoint Elisha in your stead. And then he tells him about these two kings. Anybody escapes the sword of one, the other is going to kill, and vice versa. Oh, and by the way, Elijah, there are 7,000 people in Israel, all of whom have not bowed the knee to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Did you know that? Kind of like he didn't. So I like the way that that Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks summarizes all of this, having to do with this idea of let's compare now these two men, Pinchas and the other zealot in Scripture, Eliyahu. Now, I've said this before. I really admire Eliyahu. And to my mind, to a certain extent, I guess this is why this strikes me as being so poignant. Because when I look at the prophets in Scripture and the men of Scripture, and I say, well, you know, I'm not fit to tie Moshe's shoes. And certainly I wouldn't even remotely want to be, I'd love to be compared, but I don't dare to compare myself with people, other prophets like Yahushua or any number of others. You know, David, you name it. There's a whole lot of people in Scripture, and we would aspire to be like many of them. You know, I'd love to have it said that I was a man after Yah's own heart, or whatever. But to some extent, at least when it comes to perhaps a sense of humor, I can relate better to Eliyahu. I can picture myself standing there mocking the priests of Baal. All right, that one is a lot easier for me to put myself into his position. Again, I don't claim, neither did Elisha. That's why he asked for a double portion of the spirit of that prophet. So don't claim to have his spirit of prophecy or his zeal or anything else, but at least I can relate you know, in small part to his sense of humor and to a little bit of his, perhaps, cynicism, and maybe, too, therefore, to some of his blindness, how it is that he could miss the 7,000 that haven't bowed the knee to Baal and think that he's the only one left. So, to me, again, that resonates, and that's part of the reason why I refer so frequently to this article by Albert Nock about Isaiah's job. Hey, your job, tell them what I tell you to tell them. That goes for you, Elijah. For all of you that are being called to be watchmen on the wall, your job is blow the shofar. Your job is tell them what I tell you to tell them. You don't have to know who's listening. It's beyond your pay grade. Just do what I tell you to do. And that's it. And so here you have this man of zeal who is implicitly, at least in this final story here tonight, rebuked a little bit by Elohim. One of the great scenes in the Bible. He's shown a whirlwind, an earthquake, and a fire, but Elohim is not in any of them. Then he comes to Elijah in a still, small voice, and he asks him the very same question for the second time. What are you doing here? And Elijah, poor guy, doesn't seem to get it. He responds exactly the same way that he did the first time, saying, I have been very zealous for Yahuwah Zevuot. He doesn't get it. He evidently hasn't understood what Elohim has been trying to tell him. Sometimes, prophet, sometimes it's not violent confrontation that matters. Sometimes you got to just listen for the still small voice. And in a word gently, softly spoken, you can make a bigger splash than you do when you kill the prophets of Baal. Oh, and then go appoint Elisha as your successor. Here's how Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks summarizes all of this. I think it's a great comment. Nothing in our lives, when it comes to our faith, is more risk-laden than zeal. Now think about that. Nothing is more risk-laden than to be zealous for Yahuwah. And nothing is more compelling than the truth that Elohim taught Eliyahu. that God is not to be found in the use of force, although there are times, as Pinchas showed, where it is a requirement. But it's instead in the still small voice that turns the sinner from sin. Interesting words to live by, and it's a great way to put all this discussion of the covenant of peace and how we respond to the kinds of things that we see going on in the world today around us. And I'm sure we'll have more to say on that over time, but there are times where the still small voice is something we need to listen to, in spite of the fact that when we look around, what we seem to see is earthquakes and fire and whirlwinds.